Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Amid ongoing protests across Iran sparked by the death last month of Mahsa Amini following her arrest by morality police, a top UN-appointed independent rights expert called on Thursday for a high-level probe into the matter. Javed Rehman, special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iran, also expressed alarm that 27 children have been killed so far by security forces, some of them by live ammunition, while others were beaten to death. In a statement, Mr. Rehman said that there had been chronic impunity surrounding Ms. Amini's death. This had culminated in protests throughout the country calling for justice and accountability for Ms. Amini, who died after being arrested for violating strict dress codes relating to her hijab. Iranians were also demanding respect for fundamental rights and particularly freedom of expression, the human rights expert continued, before noting that the protest movement was being led by a range of social classes in different regions, with women and youth at the forefront. Staying with human rights, a call on Thursday from a top UN panel to all countries to protect the human rights of indigenous women and girls everywhere. The appeal from the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, follows what it called the numerous human rights violations and abuses still directed at indigenous women and girls today. These include gender-based violence, inequality and discrimination, limited access to justice, education, decent jobs and healthcare, simply because of who they are, the panel said in a statement. Concrete measures to help indigenous women and girls should include their meaningful participation in decision-making, the committee members said, adding that the world's indigenous population is estimated at more than 476 million today. Current efforts to reduce harmful emissions offer little hope of avoiding climate disaster, UN climate experts said on Thursday, as they appealed for a radical transformation of the energy sector before it's too late. There's no credible pathway to limiting average temperatures rising by more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, warned the UN Environment Programme, UNEP. And this was despite legally binding promises made at the 2015 Paris Climate Conference to cut emissions. Latest data indicates that the world is on track for a temperature rise of between 2.4 and 2.6 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. But if a 45% cut in emissions can be made, global warming will be limited to 1.5 degrees Celsius, UNEP said, while a 30% reduction should keep average temperature rise to 2 degrees. In addition to ending our reliance on fossil fuels, the UN agency urged a radical overhaul of the food sector, which accounts for one-third of emissions. In a related story, a new UN report has found that forests, heaths and stretches of water are more sensitive to nitrogen pollution than previously thought. The report, published under the UNECE Convention on Air Pollution, provides updated thresholds on harmful atmospheric nitrogen pollution. Using data gathered over the last decade, leading European researchers examined a number of ecosystems, and they found that 40% of them were more fragile to nitrogen emissions than expected. The problem is linked to the massive use of fertilizers and organic matter in farming, according to the UN Economic Commission for Europe, which appealed to all governments to reduce the amount of nitrogen entering the environment. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations is warning countries around the world are falling far short of their pledges to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, putting the world on course for catastrophic global heating. An assessment by the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change released on Wednesday found pledges by countries to slash emissions nearly in half by 2030 are far below that goal, with the world on track to see emissions rise by more than 10% this decade. Without a change in course, the UN warns the planet's on track to see an average temperature rise of up to 2.9 degrees Celsius of more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke with the BBC Wednesday less than 2 weeks before the COP27 UN Climate Summit opens in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Climate change is the crisis of our lifetime, is the defining issue of today's world. So climate change remains a central priority in everything we do. If we are not able to reverse the present trend that is leading to a catastrophe in the world, we will be doomed.
Democracy Now! Will be in Sharm el-Sheikh, broadcasting live from the UN Climate Summit. The UN also issued a warning Wednesday over the three greenhouse gases that contribute most to global heating. Atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide all hit record levels this year. Methane saw its biggest year-over-year increase. Meanwhile, a new report in the British medical journal Lancet finds efforts to mitigate climate change can still deliver a future where people can not only survive but thrive. The report's lead author, Dr. Marina Romanello, said in a statement, quote, "There is clear evidence that immediate action could still save the lives of millions with a rapid shift to clean energy and energy efficiency." The Nigerian Medical Association is raising alarm about the spread of waterborne diseases in Nigeria after stark flooding killed over 600 people and left over 200,000 homes partially or completely destroyed. Aid groups say the flooding has led to a major increase in cholera cases and other preventable diseases like diarrhea and typhoid fever. Survivors are growing increasingly angry over Nigerian authorities' response to the flooding, which has displaced about 1.5 million people.
My house is flooded. My community is flooded. People are suffering. No drinking water. No light. In fact, it's a terrible situation.
Ukraine's government says it's discovered the bodies of nearly 1,000 civilians and soldiers buried in territories recaptured from Russia by a Ukrainian counteroffensive. About half the bodies were discovered in a mass grave in Izium in Ukraine's northeastern Kharkiv region. Overnight, Russia's military carried out fresh attacks on power plants, this time in central Ukraine. In southern Ukraine, officials in the Russian-occupied Kherson region say more than 70,000 people have evacuated their homes ahead of a looming battle for control over Kherson City. Meanwhile, Ukraine has deployed more of its forces near its border with Belarus, a key Russian ally. In Iran, a mass shooting at a Shia shrine in the southern city of Shiraz killed 15 people, injured another 40 on Wednesday. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack. This is a survivor of the massacre.
They chased me, and I was shot in the back, and three people died next to me. When they attacked and started shooting, I laid down on the floor, and they thought I was dead. They killed three people near me, but I managed to escape with my life.
The deadly attack came as massive protests rocked Tehran and other parts of Iran as people marked 40 days since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. Also Wednesday, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on 14 Iranian officials over the regime's brutal suppression of protests. In Georgia, another woman has come forward to claim anti-abortion. Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker pressured her into having an abortion. The unidentified woman said it happened in the 90s when they were dating and that Walker drove her to a clinic to have the procedure. On Wednesday, lawyer Gloria Allred spoke to press about her client's allegations and played audio tape of the woman.
Herschel Walker is a hypocrite, and he is not fit to be a U.S. senator. We don't need people in the U.S. Senate who profess one thing and do another. Herschel Walker says he is against women having abortions, but he pressured me to have one.
This comes as Georgians have turned out in record numbers for early voting. Nearly 60% more voters have already cast ballots, and at this point in 2018's midterms, data also show a higher proportion of Black and older voters. In Pennsylvania, Democratic Representative Mike Doyle announced Wednesday he's retiring from Congress a year after he first revealed he would not seek re-election. Congressmember Doyle told reporters, quote, "I feel an obligation to make sure that people understand that my term expires at the end of the year, that I am not seeking re-election, but there is someone that has the same name as me on the ballot," unquote. He's referring to Republican Mike Doyle, a city councilor in a Pittsburgh suburb who's seeking to replace Congressmember Mike Doyle. He's denied he's seeking to deceive voters into voting for him based on name recognition, though his campaign literature makes few references to his party affiliation. He faces Democratic nominee Summer Lee, a Pennsylvania state representative who has the backing of the Democratic Socialists of America and progressives, including Senator Bernie Sanders and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In Arizona, police are investigating a burglary at the Phoenix campaign headquarters of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Katie Hobbs. No suspects have been identified, but Hobbs' campaign has released images from a surveillance video showing an unauthorized person entering the building overnight on Monday. Hobbs currently serves as Arizona's Secretary of State. As of Monday, she'd reported a half dozen voter intimidation complaints near ballot drop boxes to police, including armed people wearing masks and tactical gear. Hobbs has reportedly received hundreds of death threats and threats of violence over the course of her campaign. Tune into Democracy Now! On November 8th for a three-hour election night special. We'll be broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. A judge has ordered former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to testify before the Georgia grand jury investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results. Meadows is believed to have set up and taken part in the Trump phone call on January 2, 2021, in which Trump pressured Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to find nearly 12,000 votes that would make Trump win the state over Joe Biden. A jury in Michigan convicted three men of providing material support for a terrorist act and other charges in the plot to kidnap Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer in 2020. Prosecutors say the men belong to the militia group Wolverine Watchmen. Paul Beller, Joseph Morrison, and Pete Musico will be sentenced in December. In Ohio, right-wing conspiracy theorists Jacob Wall and Jack Berkman pleaded guilty this week to placing thousands of robocalls spreading misinformation about voting in the lead-up to the 2020 elections. The calls targeted Democratic and voters of color in Cleveland, falsely claiming election officials would use vote-by-mail information to arrest or collect overdue debts from voters, and that the CDC would use their personal information in a mandatory vaccination program. The robocalls also went out to voters in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and New York. Elon Musk is nearing a deal to purchase Twitter for $44 billion. This week, Twitter employees circulated an open letter protesting reports Musk is planning to slash the company's workforce by 75%. Musk reportedly denied the reports Wednesday during a meeting with employees at Twitter's headquarters in San Francisco. Earlier this year, he suggested he'll allow Donald Trump to reactivate his Twitter account, which the company suspended after the January 6th insurrection. In Pennsylvania, lawyers for political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal have asked a judge for a new trial based on new evidence that cast doubt on his 1982 conviction for the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner. Lawyers for the former Black Panther and journalist said evidence and boxes discovered in the Philadelphia District Attorney's office showed his trial was tainted by racist jury selection and that one of two key witnesses sent prosecutors requests for, quote, the money owed to me. The judge said she intends to dismiss the request and set a new hearing in December. Faulkner's widow, Maureen Faulkner, was at the hearing. She also attended Monday's debate between candidates for Pennsylvania's open Senate seat, where Republican Mehmet Oz mentioned her by name. And in Haiti, well-known investigative journalist Robertson Alphonse is hospitalized in stable condition after being attacked by gunmen Tuesday in Port-au-Prince. Alphonse works at the daily newspaper Le Nouveliste and the radio station Magic 9. Also on Tuesday, a journalist who had gone missing was found dead. Gary Tess previously hosted a political talk show in the southern city of Lake High. The Inter-American Press Association said this year has been one of the deadliest on record for members of the press. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah. I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure you don't like it.
So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do. Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there, but you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Listeners, we're in for a treat. Actually, you're in for a treat because I've got something to tell you about. For the last 2 years, I've been buying Hudson Cream Flour, and it's made here in Kansas by Kansans, and it's a great product. I love it. I use it. My wife makes pie crust out of it, and I use it in my bread machine, and it works. And guess who I have on the phone? Mr. Raul Foote from what county is that up down there, and what county again?
Stafford County
in Hudson, Kansas. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas, Mr. Foote. Could you give us a little background about your product and where did it come from? How did it work?
Okay, our product is Hudson Cream Flour. And this company was founded in 1904 by a German immigrant named Gustav Krug.
Oh.
So we've been in business, 106 years?
Gracious.
We're an independent mill, privately owned. The Hudson Cream Flour label is ours, and it's a short patent flour, which means it's a finer grind of flour. It's lower in ash, and it's silkier feeling than a lot of the flours out there, which makes the texture of the products more silkier.
That makes sense. I was wondering about that, because when I use it, I noticed that there's something different about the flour. It's also available in local Kansas grocery stores. That's a big deal to me, too, right there along the big names. I mean, and really reasonably priced. It's, in many respects, listeners, you'll have a Better for Bread mark, and then right next to it, here's Hudson Cream, made in Kansas, out of Hudson, Kansas, and you just heard Mr. Foote, and this stuff is, good grief, maybe a dollar a bag cheaper. It's amazing. This is good stuff. That's why it's sifted or something, or what is this, ground? It's ground more?
No, it goes through one more sifting process than most of the flours. So basically we pull off the low-grade flour and sell it separately.
Uh-huh.
And then we take the short patent flour, and then that's what the Hudson Cream Flour is. The byproduct is called clear.
Huh, I've never heard of it.
How long
have you been with the company, and tell us a little bit about the place it's made at, Hudson, Kansas.
I've been here 33 years. The town of Hudson is around 125 people, and we employ 34.
Well, where in Kansas is Hudson?
Just about, if you took a map and put a pin right in the middle of Kansas, that's where we'd be.
Oh, really?
We're 45 miles west of Hutchinson and 23 miles south of Great Bend.
Approximately how many grocery stores in Kansas carry it? Because I know I've checked in. I know Country Mart up in Atchison, Country Mart in Holton, and Steve's IGA in Valley Falls. They all three have it. Do you know how many have it?
All the Dillon stores have it.
Good.
And any store that gets their flour from AWG out of Kansas City will have it.
And I'm sure you can ask listeners your local grocery store, and they'll get it for you, especially in Kansas. Your secretary told me yesterday when I was lining up our little talk here that quite a bit shipped out of state towards the east.
Yeah, we sell in the Appalachian states, West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, North Carolina, and Tennessee.
I did not know that. What people want to get a hold of you, you're on the internet too. This is another wonderful surprise. Could you give us your web address?
We have a web address of staffordcountyflourmills.com or hudsoncream.com.
Excellent. All right.
And you can get us on either one of those. And there's a history and everything on there that you can see about the company, and all of that's on there available too.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to bother you on a busy Friday. I understand you got some construction going on down there, but I appreciate your time spent with us on Radio Free Kansas, Mr. Foote.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Goodbye.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with John Bellamy Foster about the ever-present and increasing climate disaster.
We're inspired to deal with this topic because of our guest's new book, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. We're also joined by constitutional author and scholar Stephen Rohde to discuss some cases before this term of the Supreme Court that many feel could mark the end of American democracy.
It's a reactionary Supreme Court, more powerful, some people think, than the other two branches of the government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Time is running out for humanity to avoid a catastrophic planetary tipping point. The globalized system of capital accumulation has induced humanity to foul its own nest. The result is a planetary emergency that threatens all present and future generations and has thrown into question the continuation of civilization and ultimately the very survival of humanity itself. Only by addressing the social aspects of the current planetary environment is it possible to develop the ecological and social resources for a new journey of hope. The United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, predicts that as a result of the increase in greenhouse gases, by the year 2050, there will be 1 billion climate refugees. Temperatures must be held within 1.5 Celsius increase. If it goes up, as predicted, an increase of 4% would end all civilization. The crisis we are now in is multiple: species extinction, ocean acidification, sea level rise, depletion of soil, forest fires, broiling heat waves, hurricanes, and drought have plagued us in the last few years. One-third of Pakistan was underwater. We speak today with John Bellamy Foster. He's the editor of Monthly Review magazine and a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. He has written many books, including The Robbery of Nature and The Return of Nature. His most recent book is Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. John Bellamy Foster, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Why do you think time is running out for humanity to avoid a catastrophic planetary tipping point? Do you agree with George Monbiot that, quote, capitalism is leading us into a death spiral? Let's talk about what's going on, what we can do about it. After 1970, human activity took over from the geological processes which had affected the Earth and generated an existential crisis in the world's population. The latest IPCC report warns us of this. What's the IPCC, and what did that report say?
Well, it's interesting what the latest IPCC report, AR6, said. One of the reasons is that the third part of the report, the most important part on mitigation, was censored, in fact, rewritten from what the scientists said when the government entered in before the report was published. But if you look at the physical science part of the report, part one, they basically say that we are headed past 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature, which is considered now to be the tipping point for massive climate change. We're headed past it even in the most optimistic scenario. So in the most optimist scenario, we won't hit a 1.5 degrees increase in global average temperature until 2040, and then we will go up to a 1.6 degree increase, peaking at that, and then at the very end of the century, we'll get down below 1.5 degree increase to a 1.4 degree increase at the very end of the 21st century. But in the most optimistic scenario we're facing now, very extreme compound weather events that will dominate this century, it puts billions of people in jeopardy. But the bigger problem, of course, is stopping the fossil fuel emissions, the carbon emissions, before we go too far down the track. So we definitely want to try to stay on the below 1.5 degrees pathway, or well below 2 degrees, which is the second most optimistic scenario, or we're looking at absolute catastrophe. The next three scenarios are absolutely catastrophic, with the fifth scenario, which is what we really are on track for right now, would have a temperature increase of 4.4 degrees, the best estimate, which scientists say would be the end of industrial civilization. So we have to act very quickly. We only have a short period in which to act, and we need revolutionary scale transformations. Now, the third part of the AR6 report on mitigation, in the scientific consensus, which was developed by August 2021, in that report they explained that revolutionary scale change was necessary, that we had to go to low energy solutions and reduce demand. We had to restructure the economy. We need massive social movements to put all this in place, that the technological solutions that are propounded, like carbon capture and sequestration, are not there and can't save us from this problem, and so on. And all of these things were censored out of the published document. We know because the scientific consensus was leaked. The scientific consensus report was leaked, and we put it up on MR Online. It was leaked by Scientific Rebellion, which is part of Extinction Rebellion. And then the government intervened, rewrote the whole summary for policymakers of the AR6 Part 3, and the published version downplayed all of this. It said that we could still expand coal plants, while the scientists had said we can't. and so on. So they're basically lying to us, and the problem is becoming much more severe. We need revolutionary scale transformations according to the science, and we're not doing that at present.
My goodness, government's lying to us. My goodness, be still my heart. I can't believe it. Ah, dear. You wrote that human activities are now, of course, the main force impacting the Earth as a whole, and what has generated an existential threat to the world. What caused this massive shift in the history of the Earth from just sort of natural geological processes to the fact that it's the human activities? We've known about the approaching catastrophe, well, it's been upon us for half a century now, but the powers that be have still not done anything. Why is that the case? Those forces which are creating the crisis now, knowing full well they're doing so, nevertheless have done nothing of any real note to change it and to stop doing it.
Well, the short answer to both questions, what caused this and why we're not doing anything about it, is capitalism. This is the key. If we, you mentioned that anthropogenic factors are now the major drivers of Earth system change. This is how we define the Anthropocene epoch in geological history. In the history of the billions of years of history of the Earth, it's always been non-anthropogenic factors that have been the major drivers of the Earth system as a whole, of Earth system change. And now we have, really due to capitalism, we have now anthropogenic factors. I mean, yeah, anthropogenic factors, that is, human factors, the human beings are the major driver of Earth system change. But it's not just human beings as such. It's the nature of our society. It's capitalism that is generating this, a system that demands constant increases in the accumulation of capital, exponential increases in the accumulation of capital, regardless of the effects on humanity and the Earth system. So we have a very extreme destructive system at play. Capitalism in its early stages can be seen as having been a force for the improvement of conditions of humanity, although it also was destructive, but it was a development over the feudal society that preceded it. But now capitalism has turned into a system. It's reached a point where it's destructive of our relation to the Earth. So we have a global habitability crisis. It's a crisis of the planet as a place of human habitation, and that's being destroyed at an accelerated rate, at a rate of now of years and decades, not centuries.
For those listeners who just tuned in, I'm Attorney Michael Smith. This is Law and Disorder. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with John Bellamy Foster. John, talk about our fossil fuel capitalist economy worldwide and why it is so intractable to change.
Well, it's the fossil fuel economy, we call it fossil capital, is so intertwined with the capitalist system globally and with the financial system that, yeah, it almost requires the transformation of the entire system. It requires a radical transformation of capitalism and creating a new mode of production just to get beyond the emphasis on fossil fuels, the reliance on fossil fuels. That's the nature of the problem we have, so that although we've known this about this problem for over half a century, nothing really has been accomplished, and we're reaching the end of the line. And one of the, they talk about the clean energy transition and alternative energies all the time, but we've made very, very little progress overall in that, at least in terms of the scale of the change that's required. And one of the reasons is that even though, let's say, solar energy is competitive with fossil fuels, the global infrastructure, the infrastructure, energy infrastructure is a fossil fuel infrastructure. So we keep on building and subsidizing that fossil fuel infrastructure, which has been produced over centuries, and there is no solar or wind infrastructure that can compete with that. So we have to build an entirely different energy infrastructure at this point if we're going to keep our energy use at the same level. And the powers that be make more profits off of fossil fuels because of the existing infrastructure, and it is more profitable. The energy systems are not really on a level playing field. The other thing is that there are trillions of dollars on fossil fuel reserves. If we stopped producing or extracting fossil fuels, the oil companies and the financial capital, which have a lot of their assets in the form of these fossil fuel reserves, they would be imperiled by that because their assets would go away. The fossil fuel reserves that are below the ground are actually in play in the contemporary economy.
I wonder about, John, you know, we're all urged to recycle and to buy green, shop green, and to take a bicycle instead of a car or an electric car and all the rest. And much is made of that, of course, and it may be of some great value, I don't know. But can technology alone, can those kinds of measures alone really solve the problem?
No, not according to the science. The science says that we don't have, simply by changing our consumption, something that you tell children in the very beginning that they should, you know, we try to teach them about recycling and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is important on a moral basis and in terms of individual action. But the only thing that can get us out of this is a major social transformation, which requires political action. It can't be done by individual reductions in consumption. We have to get we have to shift in terms of our energy consumption, but you're not going to get that on an individual basis and not on the level that's needed and with the speed that's needed. That requires political action and social transformation and going against the powers that be. For example, if everybody in the United States eliminated the waste coming out of their household so there was no household waste at all, that would reduce the total amount of waste and produce ecological waste by 3%. The rest of it is all determined by the corporations. And on a level of consumption, we can't affect this. We have to affect it politically where we change the production system, the mode of production.
We're speaking with John Bellamy Foster, the editor of the wonderful magazine Monthly Review. John, capital accumulation is the driving force of the system. Why is this so irrational?
The system is geared to capital accumulation. Capitalism, in essence, is a system of the accumulation of capital. That's what it's about. That's what it does. It's constantly trying to increase the capital in the hands of a relatively few individuals, and to expand the whole system in those terms. But it's an enormously destructive, wasteful, and inefficient system. Inefficient by ecological standards, by human standards, including human health. It's an incredibly wasteful and destructive system that really has only one end, and that's the accumulation of capital in the hands of the wealthy. And the benefits are supposed to trickle down to us, but they don't. And meanwhile, the system is destroying the earth as a place of human habitation at a very, very rapid rate. What we are seeing is that the nature of the system and the expansion of the system are creating a situation where we are generating rifts. We could call them metabolic rifts in the biogeochemical cycles of the entire planet. So we're crossing numerous planetary boundaries, including climate change, but also other boundaries like species extinction, which is 1,000 times now the background rate, and we're talking about losing half of all species, as much as half of all species this century. And we have disrupted the phosphorus and nitrogen cycles. Chemical pollution is now, we've now crossed planetary boundaries on that. We are finding diminishing fresh water sources, and forests and ground cover are being destroyed. So we have these numerous planetary boundaries that we're crossing, and the cause of it, of all of it, the common denominator in all of this, these crises that are global ecological crises, is the expansion of the capitalist economic system, which leaves all of this out of account and simply is geared to the cash nexus.
This is Jim Lafferty along with co-host Michael Smith, at the moment interviewing John Bellamy Foster, of course, the editor of Monthly Review. And John, the show today was really inspired by your new book, A Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution. To whom is the book addressed, aimed at, and what dominant questions does it raise?
Well, the important thing is, you know, the title, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, basically captures the two aspects of the crisis, the planetary crisis that we're in. Capitalism is really the cause of the crisis. It's ecological destruction. But we also have to understand that this is not the same as what came before, that we're in an entirely new period of history, and actually a new period of geological history, where in the past the system destroyed local environments and people could move on, but there was regional and local environmental destruction. But now, according to the science, the economic system, capitalism, to give it a name, is disrupting the biogeochemical cycles of the entire Earth system, and therefore jeopardizing all human life. We're talking about the reports are coming out of scientific studies indicate that we may have as many as 1 billion climate refugees by 2050. Certainly hundreds of millions, billions of people are already being threatened by what is happening. The consequences that are enormous, we saw this summer heat waves across the entire northern hemisphere, which were unprecedented, particularly in the high and middle latitudes. And this is a sign of what is going to come, and on an even bigger scale, if we can't restrain the system that we're in. So the two problems, you know, we now have capitalism, but we now have capitalism in the Anthropocene, an Anthropocene that the system has generated, but now threatens to overwhelm us all, because it means an Earth system that is in crisis, at least in terms of human habitability, in terms of the planet as a place for human habitation. And we can't get away from this unless we go against the political economic system and the mode of production that we've generated. I argue, and scientists Carl Soriano and myself and Brett with Brett Clark have argued, that we could call the new geological age of the Anthropocene as the Capitolinian age. This is the first age of the Anthropocene is an Anthropocene crisis dominated by capitalism. We have to create a new geological age, which we call the communion, based on community, communal, and commons, and in which we have a sustainable relation to the earth, a process of sustainable human development. We stabilize our relation to the earth, but to do that, we have to go in a socialist direction, that is, towards a society based on substantive equality and ecological sustainability.
John, you've said and written that in America, three men own 60% of the country. Who are these three men, and what do you mean when you say that the power, therefore, has to be democratized, that the system of production needs to be reordered? You've said that the key is who owns and controls production. So talk to us about this.
Well, three men are what? Bezos, Bill Gates, and
Mr. Tesla, yeah.
Musk. Bezos, Gates, and Musk own as much wealth as the bottom 60% of the U.S. population. The economy is, and the society are geared to those hyper-capitalist interests, to a billionaire class, as Bernie Sanders says, and to their hangers-on, and not towards the population as a whole. When I teach classes to my undergraduates, a lot of the students think that the system in the United States is democracy. I say, well, no, the system isn't democracy. The system is capitalism. And understanding that is key. That is our problem. That is what we have to confront. And the fact that we haven't been able to deal with any of these problems, we haven't been able to address them, that it gets worse and worse. The Inflation Reduction Act is a fraud, and the reason it gets worse and worse is because the nature of our system does not allow for the changes that are needed in order to protect humanity, in order for human survival, because the goal is one of institutionalized greed and accumulation of capital, and the population can go to the wall. Look at in Pakistan, a third of Pakistan was flooded, and this is a result of this system. It isn't democracy if you promote a political economic situation and ecological destruction that endangers the entire population of the earth. That can't be democracy.
John, unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time, but I do want to ask you a couple of questions. I'm going to end up asking you, how can people contact you? How can people get your new book? But before I ask you that, I wanted to know, we cannot have massive ecological change without massive social change, of course. And the people of the USA, you've said, especially young people, they want change and they know this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, change is coming no matter what. I mean, we're continuing to talk in a naive way where we separate the fundamental issues. We're talking here of the most massive changes in the entire history of humanity, and these changes are coming upon us as a result of the nature of our social system. We're talking about, in this century, a situation where industrial civilization could could come down. In fact, we're heading that way. In the time of in the lifespan of many people on Earth today, not very many decades ahead, and the time in which to act is now, the necessary time to act. But we're talking about the most massive changes that anybody has experienced. We're already seeing extreme weather events and compounded extreme weather events all over the Earth. And in the next years and decades, this is going to get worse. And if we don't stop it, it's going to be absolutely catastrophic. So, and political systems aren't going to be stable under these circumstances. Economic systems aren't going to be stable. If we don't decide to promote a socialist or eco-socialist answer to this, if we don't organize for peace and the environment and a socialist solution, we're going to see the growth of more war, fascism, on top of this deteriorating situation. There is no way in which people can stand still now. They have, and there's no way that they can avoid major change. We simply have to decide how we're going to act. And we have to organize at this point for our communities, because the disasters are absolutely enormous, and they're hitting communities in the United States as well as the rest of the world. And we have to organize for the survival of people who are threatened by this. And we have to do it on a community and basis, on an egalitarian basis, in terms of eco-socialist principles, utilizing planning, putting people first before profits and the environment. We have to do this because we're faced with these disasters. And if we just stand still, and I think we can see that, we're going to have more and more wars over resources. We're going to see the most reactionary developments in political systems as they try to hold this together. And there'll be increasing likelihood of nuclear war. We either deal with the system and the problems it has generated, or we suffer the cost.
John Bellamy Foster, Jim and I want to thank you very, very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. I want to remind our listeners that you've just come out with your new book, Capitalism in the Anthropocene, Ecological Ruin or Ecological Revolution, and also that you're the editor of the wonderful magazine. I've been reading it for 55 years. It's called Monthly Review, and people should get the book and subscribe to the magazine. And John, we really appreciate your being on the show.
Indeed we do, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
A recent New York Times article by David Leonhard titled, A Crisis Coming, the two twin threats to American democracy. Leonhardt, after first identifying the first threat being that things are now in place where for the first time in U.S. history, a legitimately elected president will not be able to take office. He identifies the second threat as follows, and I quote, "The second threat to democracy is chronic but also growing. The power to set government policy is becoming increasingly disconnected from public opinion. The run of Supreme Court decisions, both sweeping and, according to polls, unpopular, highlight this disconnect. Although the Democratic Party has won the popular vote in 7 of the past 8 elections, a Supreme Court dominated by Republican appointees seems poised to shape American politics for years, if not decades." And another headline in a recent edition of the New York Times reads as follows, "Three huge Supreme Court cases that could change America." And that article is simply one of many of late, warning of how the ever more conservative, indeed one could say reactionary Supreme Court, in its just opened fall term, may well change America, change it in a number of vastly different ways and ways inconsistent with the majority political views of the American people. Well, to help us understand this looming danger, I can think of really no better guest than ours today. Steve Rohde is the past chair of the American Civil Liberties Union of Foundation of Southern California. He is the founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. He's a widely recognized expert on the U.S. Constitution as well as a political activist. He is a prolific author. His books include American Words of Freedom and the book Freedom of Assembly. He has written numerous book reviews and articles on civil liberties and constitutional law, and indeed his book reviews can be found frequently in the Los Angeles Review of Books. Steve Rohde, a warm welcome back to the Law and Disorder Show.
Thank you, Jim. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Steve, are you as concerned, as alarmed, really, as are many other constitutional experts and civil libertarians by what the Supreme Court, well, what it's done over the last year or so, this last term or so, and may well do during its just open fall term, what it may do to life and governance in America? And if you do share that concern, why is that?
I am, Jim. You know, in the founding period, Alexander Hamilton called the judiciary the least dangerous branch because it didn't have control over guns or the treasury. But I'm convinced, I think others like Lawrence Tribe and other commentators and constitutional law experts are convinced that this court is becoming the most dangerous branch of government, at least in terms of the issues it addresses and the interpretation of the Constitution. Last term, the 6-member super-conservative majority implemented the conservative Republican playbook. It was anti-abortion, pro-gun, pro-church, and pro-business. And they did all of it by elevating a theory of originalism that Robert Bork and Justice Scalia tried for years to force on the court, and now there is this conservative group that believes the Constitution is frozen in the 18th century, and that's how it should be interpreted.
Steve, there are at least 3 key cases or issues now before the Supreme Court that have alarmed you and me and Jim and other constitutional scholars. Could you first talk about the Merrill versus Milligan case, which is a voting rights case?
This is a very important case. Briefly, the facts are pretty clear. Alabama imposed a congressional map that diluted the power of black voters in Alabama. 27% of Alabama's population is black, but only 1 out of 7 congressional districts has a black majority. So a district court, 3 judges, unanimously found it was likely that this Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act was violated, and it ordered the state
to create a second black majority district. Before that case could even be briefed and argued, five Supreme Court justices stayed the ruling. In dissent were the three liberals, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, and Roberts. And they found there was no intent requirement, so that gerrymandering is going into effect in the fall elections next month. Now, this case was the first case argued on October 4, and the only glimmer of hope is the appearance of the new Supreme Court Justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. She took a hold of this case. She was active in the oral argument. She pressed the Attorney General of Alabama to explain why the Voting Rights Act didn't take race into consideration, since that was the very purpose of the act, which has been ratified and renewed by Congresses throughout the years. She pushed him hard. We have no idea what the court will do. I have a feeling Ketanji Brown Jackson is going to be a major force on this court.
Well, let's hope. Another, though, of the particularly worrisome cases is, of course, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, and a separate but related case by the same plaintiffs, Students for Fair Admissions versus University of North Carolina. Both are affirmative action cases. So talk to us, Steve, about the issue involved in these cases and why we should be alarmed by how the Supreme Court, well, may likely rule in the cases.
These are very important cases when it comes to affirmative action and the lives of hundreds of thousands of students across the country. They involve a public university, North Carolina, and a private university, Harvard. Oral argument is set for October 31st. Unfortunately, Ketanji Brown Jackson has recused herself because she previously served on the board of overseers at Harvard. What this case presents the possibility of turning back decades of law, settled law by the Supreme Court with justices across the political spectrum. Many will remember the Bakke case in 1976, holding that race may be considered as one factor in college admission. That was ratified and renewed in Rutter in 2003 and in Fisher in 2016. But the Fisher case had an ominous dissent from Roberts, Thomas, and Alito, challenging the entire question of whether affirmative action was constitutional. At stake here is, for a public university, is the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which again takes race into consideration. And in a private college setting, Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act for recipients of federal funds cannot discriminate on the basis of race. Given these justices thrashing through precedent, ignoring stare decisis last term, I am very concerned about these cases.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with our friend and colleague Steve Rohde, constitutional scholar. Steve, the third case is Moore versus Harper, where the issue is partisan gerrymandering, in which government, the state government or the federal government, has the power over elections. Many experts believe this could prove to be the most important case now to be decided this term by the Supreme Court. Explain what's at stake here, please.
Yes, and I join in that view, not only for the election of congresspersons, but the election of our president. The North Carolina Supreme Court struck down a Republican redistricting map which would probably have given two more Republican seats in Congress. They already have 10 out of 14 seats, even though the population is roughly 50-50. In March, the Supreme Court let that ruling stand, which is a good thing because that gerrymandered map was struck down. But Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch dissented. What this case introduces, and it's a technical legal concept, but it's important for everybody to understand it, it's the independent state legislature theory. Under this theory, which was originally proposed by Justice Rehnquist in a concurring opinion back in Bush v. Gore, is that state legislatures have total authority to draw congressional maps and also choose electors for the Electoral College. And none of these legislative decisions could be reviewed even by their own state courts. Now, today, Republicans have 30 states in which they control both houses. This could set a precedent for presidential elections, allowing state legislatures to choose electors despite the popular vote. It is terrifying to think that after the 2020 election and all of that, that by installing state secretaries of state and state legislatures, that this truly could be a case of stealing the election.
The public approval rating of the U.S. Supreme Court following the overruling by the court of Roe v. Wade fell to under 30%, and some polls down as far as 25%. More and more, the unelected lifetime justices of the Supreme Court, the third branch of government, seems to have more power than either the legislative or executive branch of government, reminding me of what you started off this interview reminding us of in terms of what the founding fathers had in mind when it came to the Supreme Court. Aren't they now, in fact, operating pretty much in a legislative fashion for all practical purposes?
I'm very concerned about judicial overreach. The history of the court is stained by periods when the court either through judicial restraint or judicial activism has either failed to protect constitutional rights or has actively overturned laws or policies that protect constitutional rights. I do believe the court has a duty to exercise its authority in favor of expanding constitutional rights. So I don't think it's a case of judicial restraint or judicial activism. They need to view the Constitution the way a wonderful Justice William Brennan viewed it, as a living Constitution. And I'm very worried that this supermajority is going in the opposite direction.
Steve, in light of what you've just said so far, would it be fair to say that David Leonhardt, the author of the New York Times article on how the Supreme Court is a threat to what's left of American democracy, be correct? Has the Supreme Court in recent years acted as a de facto super legislative branch of the government? Has it served to deny to the American people the legislative measures that a great majority of Americans support?
Here again, I think we have to be cautious about insisting that the Supreme Court follow the will of the majority. During our history, majorities have supported slavery. Majorities have denied rights to women, people of color, and LGBTQ communities. The purpose of the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment is to place certain decisions involving fundamental constitutional rights of the kind we find in the First Amendment and other portions of the Bill of Rights, including a woman's right to choose whether or not to give birth. We've got to place those beyond majorities and legislatures. So once again, it's not one size fits all. There is a fear that the court must uphold those fundamental rights, and in some cases, if a legislature has banned abortion, then they do need to strike that legislative judgment down because it denies fundamental rights.
Well, given that the ultra-conservative makeup of the Supreme Court is likely to be with us for years and years, what do you believe, if anything, can be done or should be done to rein in the gross abuse of its intended role?
I think we have to take a real serious look at term limits and age limits to rotate and rejuvenate the justices' terms inside the United States. Do you know that we are the only major constitutional democracy in the world that has neither a retirement age on its highest court nor fixed terms for high court justices? 27 countries, many constitutional democracies that would come to mind, have term limits. President Biden appointed a presidential commission on the Supreme Court. It rendered a preliminary report last December. It offers the idea of staggered 18-year terms, which would assure each president would appoint two justices in any four-year term. I think those reforms, we don't need to pack the court, because if a political party hostile to constitutional rights ever maintained control for several years, they would pack the court with conservatives. I think term limits and age limits are serious. I know that Barack Obama recently spoke to that, and many others have.
Yeah, I agree. We're coming down to the end of our allotted time, unfortunately, Steve, but I wanted to ask you two things. One, in a nutshell, your last thoughts, and secondly, how can people find your writings and follow your work?
Well, you're very kind. Look, the Supreme Court, as presently constituted, is as much a political branch of the federal government as the executive and legislative branches. The presidents we elect, the senators we elect, nominate and approve justices. If we want to change the Supreme Court, we need to elect presidents and senators who support justices, who believe in a living constitution that follows evolving standards of decency that mark a civilized society in the mold of Justices Earl Warren, William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the three liberal women on today's Supreme Court. I think we have to see the Supreme Court as much of a political issue in these coming elections, because we're electing senators who approve and consent Supreme Court justices, and in 2024 we have to take all of these issues into consideration. I'm always so grateful when you have me on your show. Many of my book reviews and articles can be found at lareviewofbooks.org /contributor /Stephen-Rohde, and that's R-O-H-D-E, and I'm always happy to hear from your listeners.
Yes, and Steve, and our listeners, I know, are happy to hear from you as well. And we thank you so much, really, for joining us today again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, guys. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you.
you think you can tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell? Did they get you to train your heroes for gold? Hot ashes for trees, hot air for a cool breeze, cold comfort for change. Did you exchange a walk-on part in the war for a lead?
There's something else that is said after a death. This one happens after the funeral, after the burial, back at the house. Sooner or later, someone is bound to say the following, especially after a few drinks. You know, I think he's up there now, smiling down at us. And I think he's pleased, smiling down at
smiling
us.
Down, smiling down, smiling down.
And I think he's
and I
pleased,
think he's pleased. Think
smiling,
he's
down,
smiling
at us.
Down, smiling down.
Welcome to and New I World Notes. I am Kenneth Darst. This week marks the third anniversary of the death of America's greatest left-of-center comic and satirist, George Carlin. Carlin passed away on June 22, 2008. That last sentence is in part a joke, of course. Passed away. Carlin famously hated all euphemisms. If he had thought I were serious, by now his ghost would be chewing out my backside, shouting, "I didn't pass away, you I died!" To Carlin, if you had two busted legs, you were a cripple, and there's no disrespect to you in the word. It's no failing on your part if you're a cripple. But don't dare to tell him that you're physically challenged. And don't even dream of telling him, I'm not handicapped, I'm handy-capable. If you did, he'd advise you to go perform a sexual act that even the able-bodied would find difficult. Why, because he despised cripples? No, because he thought society had a duty to care for cripples, and the poor, and the hungry, and the unemployed, and, as we shall hear, the homeless. And naming each group with some euphemism makes it easier to say that they don't really need our help in the first place. How convenient. We won't hear his cripple routine today, but we'll hear another great Carlin attack on euphemisms when he analyzes the BS English spoken by the airlines. I've condensed some of Carlin's stuff, and I've had to censor a lot of words for radio. I believe that all of these routines were recorded in the early 1990s. That's a decade before 9/11. Amazing how little has changed since Carlin spoke two decades ago. Carlin did not earn a college degree. I'm not even sure he earned a high school diploma. He said that his most important experience with formal education was the year he spent in a very good high school run by Jesuit priests. They showed him the importance of thinking critically, Carlin said. Unfortunately for the Jesuits and their bosses in the Vatican, Carlin's critical thinking skills led him to reject all organized religion as a fraud. We'll start off with his analysis of the Christian church and with the preposterous God character that, as he sees it, they invented.
In the booth department, a businessman can't hold a candle to a clergyman. Because I got to tell you the truth, folks. I got to tell you the truth. When it comes to bullshit, big time, major league bullshit, you have to stand in awe of the all-time champion of false promises and exaggerated claims, religion. No contest. No contest. Religion. Religion easily has the greatest bullshit story ever told. Think about it. Religion has actually convinced people that there's an invisible man living in the sky who watches everything you do every minute of every day. And the invisible man has a special list of 10 things he does not want you to do. And if you do any of these 10 things, he has a special place full of fire and smoke and burning and torture and anguish where he will send you to live and suffer and burn and choke and scream and cry forever and ever till the end of time. But he loves you. He loves you and he needs money. He always needs money. He's all-powerful, all-perfect, all-knowing, and all-wise. Somehow, just can't handle money. Religion takes in billions of dollars, they pay no taxes, and they always need a little more. Now, you talk about a good book story. Holy
On New World Notes, we continue our tribute to George Carlin, who died 3 years ago, June 22, 2008. Like many satirists, Carlin was a keen analyst of the abuse of language. Social critics from Swift to Orwell to Robert Fisk understood that deceiving and oppressing the citizens is easier if you can corrupt the language they speak. Collateral damage sounds so much more acceptable than bombing unarmed civilians. For that matter, air power sounds so much nicer than dropping bombs on people from the sky. Many of Carlin's routines are on this theme. Here's a good one, on the language spoken in the friendly skies by the airlines.
Something else we have in common, flying on the airlines and listening to the airlines' announcements. And trying to pretend to ourselves that the language they're using is really English. Doesn't seem like it to me. About this time, someone is telling you to get on the plane. Get on the plane, get on the plane. I say, F*** you, I'm getting in the plane. In the plane. Let Evel Knievel get on the plane. I'll be in here with you folks in uniform. There seems to be less wind in here. They might tell you you're on a non-stop flight. Well, I don't think I care for that. No, I insist that my flight stop. Preferably at an airport. It's those sudden, unscheduled cornfield and housing development stops that seem to interrupt the flow of my day. Here's one they just made up. Near miss. When two planes almost collide, they call it a near miss. It's a near hit. A collision is a near miss. Look, they nearly missed. Yes, but not quite. They might tell you your flight has been delayed because of a change of equipment. Broken plane. Tell me to put my seat back forward. Well, I don't bend that way. If I could put my seat back forward, I'd be in porno movies. Then they mentioned carry-on luggage. First time I heard carry-on, I thought they were going to bring a dead deer on board. I thought, what the hell do they mean with that? Don't they have the little TV dinners anymore? Then I thought, carry on, there's going to be a party. People are going to be carrying on the plane. Well, I don't care for that. I like a serious attitude on the plane, especially on the flight deck, which is the latest euphemism for cockpit. Can't imagine why they wouldn't want to use a lovely word like cockpit, can you? Especially with all those stewardesses going in and out of it all the time. As soon as they close the door to the aircraft, that's when they begin the safety lecture. I love the safety lecture. This is my favorite part of the airplane ride. I listen very carefully to the safety lecture, especially that part where they teach us how to use the seatbelt. Imagine this. Here we are, a plane full of grown human beings, many of us partially educated, and they're actually taking time out to describe the intricate workings of a belt buckle. Place the small metal flap into the buckle. Well, I asked for clarification at that point. The safety lecture continues. The next thing they do, they tell you to locate your nearest emergency exit. I do this immediately. I locate my nearest emergency exit, and then I plan my route. I say, let's see, I'll go around the fat step on the widow's head, push those children out of the way, knock down the paralyzed midget, and get out of the plane where I can help others. I can be of no help to anyone if I'm lying unconscious in the aisle with some big standing on my head. I must get out of the plane, go to a nearby farmhouse, have a Dr. Pepper, and call the police. The safety lecture continues. In the unlikely event... This is a very suspect phrase, especially coming as it does from an industry that is willing to lie about arrival and departure times. In the unlikely event of a sudden change in cabin pressure... Roof flies off. An oxygen mask will drop down in front of you. Place the mask over your face and breathe normally. Well, I have no problem with that. I always breathe normally when I'm in a 600-mile-an-hour uncontrolled vertical dive. I also normally. Right in my pants! They tell you to adjust your oxygen mask before helping your child with his. I did not need to be told that. In fact, I'm probably going to be too busy screaming to help him at all. This will be a good time for him to learn self-reliance. If he can program his VCR, he can jolly well learn to adjust an oxygen mask. Fairly simple thing, just a little rubber band in the back is all it is. Not nearly as complicated as, say, for instance, a seatbelt. The safety lecture continues. In the unlikely event of a water landing. Well, what exactly is a water landing? Am I mistaken, or does this sound somewhat similar to crashing into the ocean? Your seat cushion can be used as a flotation device. Well, imagine that. My seat cushion. Just what I need to float around the North Atlantic for several days, clinging to a pillow full of beer farts. The flight continues. A little later on, toward the end, we hear, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. Well, who gives a shit who turned it on? What does that have to do with anything? It's on, isn't it? And who made this man a captain, might I ask? Did I sleep through some sort of an armed forces swearing-in ceremony or something? Captain, he's a f***ing pilot, and let him be happy with that. If those sightseeing announcements are any mark of his intellect, he's lucky to be working at all. Tell the captain, Air Marshal Carlin says, go f*** yourself.
Next, Carlin shows how to end homelessness. His suggestions are so simple and so obvious, it's amazing that after 2 decades, no one has yet put them into practice. Let's have a listen.
By the way, speaking of American values, aren't we about due to start bombing some small country that only has a marginally effective air force? Seems to me like we're weeks overdue to drop high explosives on helpless civilians. People who have no argument with us whatsoever. I think we ought to be out there doing what we do best, gang, making large holes in other people's countries. I hate to be repetitious, but we are a warlike lot. We can't stand it not to be f***ing with somebody. We couldn't wait for that Cold War to be over, could we? Couldn't wait for the Cold War to be over so we can go and play with our toys in the sand. Go and play with our toys in the sand. And when we're not invading some sovereign nation or setting it on fire from the air, which is more fun for our Nintendo pilot, then we're usually declaring war on something here at home. You ever notice that about us? We love to declare war on things here in America. Anything we don't like about ourselves, we declare war on it. We don't do anything about it. We just declare war on it. It's the only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving problems, declaring war. We have to declare a war on everything. We have a war on crime, the war on poverty, the war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice, we got no war on homelessness, huh? No war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. No money to be made off of the homeless. If you could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of million dollars each, you'd see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty damn quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that. Yeah. I got an idea. You know what they ought to do? Give the homeless their own magazine. Give them their own magazine. It would make them feel better, for one thing. That's a sure sign of making it in this country. Every group in this country that arrives at a certain level has its own magazine. We have Working Mother magazine, Black Entrepreneur magazine, Hispanic Business magazine. In fact, any activity engaged in by more than 4 people in this country has got a magazine devoted to it. Skydiving, snowmobiling, backpacking, mountain climbing, bungee jumping, skeet shooting, duck hunting, jerking off, playing pool, shooting someone in the hole with a dart gun. They probably got a magazine for that. Walking! For Christ's sakes, walking! there's actually a magazine called Walking. Look, Dan, the new Walking is out. Here's a good article, putting one foot in front of the other. Give them their own magazine. Give them their own magazine. You know what you call the magazine for the homeless? Better Crates and Cartons. Yeah, then when they get finished reading it, they can use it to line their clothing. That's a good sound business solution, isn't it? That's the kind of answer you get from a conservative American businessman in this country. Say, yeah, let them read it. When they get finished reading it, they can use it to plug up the holes in them piano crates they all seem to like to live in. A good sound, practical, conservative American business solution. I got an idea about homelessness. You know what they ought to do? Change the name of it. Change the name of it. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. It's houses these people need. A home is an abstract idea. A home is a setting. It's a state of mind. These people need houses, physical, tangible structures. They need low-cost housing. But where are you going to put it? Well, that's fine, but where are you going to put it? Where are you going to put it? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country, you've heard of it, it's called NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything, any kind of social help located anywhere near them. You try to open up a halfway house. Try to open up a drug rehab or an alcohol rehab center. Try to do a homeless shelter somewhere. Try to open up a little home for some retarded people who want to work their way into the community. People say, not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them, especially if it might help somebody else. Part of that great American spirit of generosity we hear about. Great, generous American spirit. You can ask an Indian about that. Ask an Indian about if you can find one. You've got to locate an Indian first. We've made them just a little difficult to find. Well, if you need current data, select a black family at random. Ask them how generous America has been to them. People don't want anything near them, even if it's something they believe in, something they think society needs, like prisons. Everybody wants more prisons, right? Everybody wants more prisons. People say, build more prisons! But not here. But why not? What's wrong? What's the problem? What's wrong with having a prison in your neighborhood? It seemed to me like it would make it a pretty crime-free area, don't you think? You think a lot of crackheads and pimps and hookers and thieves are going to be hanging around in front of a prison? They ain't coming anywhere near it. What's wrong with these people? All the criminals are locked up behind the walls, and if a couple of them do break out, what do you think they're going to do? Hang around? Check real estate trends? They're gone. That's the whole idea of breaking out of prison, is to get the as far away as you possibly can. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them. Except military bases. They don't mind that, do they? They like that. Give them an army base. Give them a navy base. Makes them happy. Why? Jobs. Jobs. Self-interest. Even if the base is loaded with nuclear weapons, they don't give a f***. They say, well, I'll take a little radiation if I can get a job. Working people have been f***ed over so long in this country, those are the kind of decisions they're left to make. I've got just the place for low-cost housing. I have solved this problem. I know where we can build housing for the homeless. Golf courses. Perfect. Golf courses. Just what we need. Just what we need. Plenty of good land in nice neighborhoods. Land that is currently being wasted on a meaningless, mindless activity engaged in primarily by white, well-to-do male businessmen who use the game to get together to make deals to carve this country up a little finer among themselves. I am getting tired, really getting tired of these golfing suckers in their green pants and their yellow pants and their orange pants and their precious little hats and their cute little golf carts. It is time to reclaim the golf courses from the wealthy and turn them over to the homeless. Golf is an arrogant, elitist game, and it takes up entirely too much room in this country. Too much room in this country. It is an arrogant game on its very design alone. Just the design of the game speaks of arrogance. Think of how big a golf course is. The ball is that big. What do these pinheaded need with all that land?
There are over 17,000 golf courses in America. They average over 150 acres apiece. That's 3 million plus acres. 4,820 square miles. You could build two Rhode Islands and a Delaware for the homeless on the land currently being wasted on this meaningless, mindless, arrogant, elitist, racist, there's another thing, the only blacks you'll find in country clubs are carrying trays, and a boring game. Boring game for boring people. You ever watch golf on television? It's like watching flies. And a mindless game. Mindless. Think of the intellect it must take to draw pleasure from this activity. Hitting a ball with a crooked stick and then walking after it. And then hitting it again. I say pick it up. You're lucky you found the thing. Put it in your pocket and go the home. You're a winner. You're a winner. You found it.
No. Never happened. No. No chance of that happening. Jorko in the plaid knickers is going to hit it again and walk some more. Let these rich suckers play miniature golf. Let them with a windmill for an hour and a half or so. See if there's really any skill among these people. Now, I know there are some people who play golf who don't consider themselves rich. Them. And shame on them for engaging in an arrogant, elitist pastime. Hey, here's another place we could put some low-cost housing. Cemeteries. There's another idea whose time has passed. Saving all the dead people and for one part of town? What the hell kind of a medieval, superstitious, religious bullshit idea is that? Plow these motherfuckers. Up, plow them into the streams and rivers of America. We need that phosphorus for farming. If we're going to recycle, let's get serious. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Finally, let's have Carlin discuss the problem with euphemisms directly. In truth, his analysis is as good as any I've seen or heard.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. But But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that.
Well, George, even though you weren't a believer, perhaps you wouldn't mind my saying, rest in peace. We miss you and we need you more than ever. And thank you, dear listener, for listening. New World Notes is produced at the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Till I get to my non-carborundum, keep trying to live each day as though the truth were true, and please tune in again next week. As my students used to write, C-H-O-W. Ciao.